Christmas, a feast to the Lord. That is a declarative statement. Let's explore that. I'll begin reading from Wikipedia, which is actually citing, in this case, the Encyclopedia of Philosophy and Religion, Christian Religion. Wikipedia says, Christmas traditions for many nations include the installing and lighting of Christmas trees, the hanging of Advent wreaths, Christmas stockings, candy canes, setting out cookies and milk, and the creation of nativity scenes depicting the birth of Jesus Christ. Christmas carols may be sung and stories told about figures as the baby Jesus, Saint Nicholas, Santa Claus, Father Christmas, Christkind, or Grandfather Frost. The sending and exchange of Christmas card greetings, observance of fasting, and special religious observances such as midnight mass or vespers on Christmas Eve. The burning of a Yule log and giving and receiving of presents are also common practice. Along with Easter, Christmas is one of the most important periods on the Christian calendar, and it is often closely associated with other holidays at this time of year, such as Advent, the Feast of Immaculate Conception, St. Nicholas Day, St. Stephen's Day, New Year's Day, and the Feast of the Epiphany. Merriam-Webster, in her very first entry, when you look up the definition of holiday, her very number one entry is Holy Day. Is Holy Day. And there is a big connection between Christmas as a holy day and the way that many people understand holy days. There is. Let me read from encyclopedia.com under Christmas. As Christmas became reconfigured as more of a commercial holiday, two objections to this transition arose. The first was from religious conservatives who argued it was important to put Christ back into Christmas. Listen to the cultural battle here. And to focus on making the celebration one that focused on heavenly virtues such as charity and sacrifice rather than more earthly desires. The second controversy emerged as the nation began to engage in a dialogue around the issue of what it means to live in an increasingly multicultural, multi-ethnic society. John Leo argues that the underlying Christian theme of Christmas means those who embrace other religions such as Judaism and Islam, as well as those who do not share a European heritage, they feel excluded from such a culturally pervasive celebration. Elizabeth Pleck asserts that Jews have responded by elevating Hanukkah. And so during this period, you'll often see Hanukkah with lights and all the accoutrements of that as they elevated Hanukkah, which really was a relatively minor holiday in Jewish circles. Leo asserts that rather than trying to include these new religions, civic authorities have taken steps to eliminate any religious theme or allusion to Christmas. Such measures include the banning of Christmas trees, nativity scenes, and poinsettias in public places, and banning religious themes in workplaces. So you have two battles going on. One is from the conservative religious sector, we must put Christ back into Christmas. And the other is because of the multiculturalism and the joining of all these cultures and different religions, we anesthetize Christmas. And we take out all the accoutrements of Christmas. That's the battle. So the emergence of Christmas and the debate on religion in schools and the banning of holiday celebrations from the curriculum, that's what's taking place. And they go on to summarize. The celebration of Christmas has affected many segments of American society, including religion, tourism, shopping, entertaining, media offerings, and moreover, many of its traditions, such as decorations, the trees, and gift wrappings, have contributed to the growth of other holidays. Finally, Christmas has become one of the central engines driving American consumer culture. And that is certainly true. In terms of economics, at least in America, that's one of the driving underlying foundational issues for the period of Christmas, because it's marketing, it's economics, it's materialism, it's adding to the bottom line. That's very important. Now again, the title of the message is Christmas, a Feast to the Lord. Now we're going to begin our analysis with the pagan origins of this particular feast. And you can go to any encyclopedia. I've gone to about three or four. I'll cite those with the statements that are made. You can go to any encyclopedia. Look online. Look in Encyclopedia Britannica online. Encyclopedia.com. And you'll find this information. Here's what they say about Christmas. The origins of the holiday and its December date lie in the ancient Greco-Roman world, as commemorations probably began sometime in the 2nd century. So, it begins sometime in the 2nd century. Now, Christ wasn't born in the 2nd century. You understand that. He died in around 30-31 A.D., so somewhere along the line, 70 years afterwards, you have perhaps the granules, the beginnings of keeping of Christmas, at least in the Greco-Roman world. In the 3rd century, the Roman Empire, which at the time had not adopted Christianity, celebrated the rebirth of the unconquered sun, Sol Invictus, on December 25th. And December 25th, it marks the return of longer days after the winter solstice, but also following the popular Roman festival called Saturnalia, during which the people feasted and exchanged gifts. Saturnalia, the most popular of Roman festivals, dedicated the Roman god Saturn. The festival's influence continues to be felt throughout the Western world. The influence of the Saturnalia upon the celebrations of Christmas and the New Year has been direct. It was also the birthday of the Indo-European deity Mithra, a god of light and loyalty, whose cult was at the time growing popular among Roman soldiers. The church in Rome began formally celebrating Christmas on December 25th, and 336. That's a long time after the birth of Christ. And they did this during the reign of Emperor Constantine. Now, that's a story in itself, because it was really a way to unify the empire, a way to consolidate power and bring everybody on the same page. Father Christmas predates the Santa Claus character and was first recorded in the 15th century, but was associated with holiday merrymaking and drunkenness. That's from the New World Encyclopedia. Santa Claus rewards those good, and if they've been that bad, they have to face a character named Krampus. Who is Krampus, you ask? Good question. Krampus was more of a European origin, and it's still celebrated today. Now, Krampus, he was a half-man, half-goat demon figure. And he was Santa Claus's counterpart. There was the one who had to initiate the pain for the naughty children. And that's what Krampus's role was. Now, it's interesting. I'll show you a little video here. You can go on National Geographic. You can Google this. It's a 2-minute video. Watch it, see it. But I'll show it here. Let's see if I can play it. That's Krampus. He's quite the character, isn't he? Reminds me of some of the Halloween associations as well. But you can see the pagan associations. They're strewn throughout this day. And if you just casually look, you can see them. The date of December 25th was celebrated as that of the reborn pagan god of Babylon, Nimrod, or Tammuz. You can find that at mysterybabylon.org, Christmas. And the queen, Semiramis, the queen of Assyria, told the worshippers that when Tammuz, also known as Nimrod, was killed, some of his blood fell on the stump of an evergreen tree, and the stump grew into a full new tree overnight. This made the evergreen tree sacred by the blood of Tammuz. Now, the evergreen tree is one of those trees that if you look in the winter, it remains green. And so the pagans looked at that and said, that symbolizes life. Immortal life, everlasting life. And so that's how it became adopted into the Christian world. Now, who was this Semiramis and Tammuz? Well, here's another video I'll show you. And this one's by Joseph Tupos. It's called The Birth of Tammuz and Polytheism.
We know that Nimrod met a violent and untimely death, but there are contrasting stories as to why and how it happened. Some have suggested it was at the hands of Shem's descendants, who had become outraged at what Nimrod was attempting to do in Babylon. Others suggest it was an act of rebellion by a band of his subjects. The most intriguing and most shocking version of events, however, is that he was killed by Semiramis, his wife. Nimrod was by all accounts a brilliant tactician, but it seems he made a fatal flaw in allowing Semiramis to retain control over the religion, because it was the religion that was the true source of power behind his rule. Through it, she won the hearts and minds of the people, and she used it to her advantage when a schism developed between herself and Nimrod. She had become pregnant with an illegitimate son. When Nimrod heard about this, he threatened to dethrone her and expose her true origins as a prostitute. But Semiramis retaliated by devising a plot to overthrow him and retain power for herself. The story goes that she had the priests kill him on her behalf at an annual New Year feast. The Babylonian people were then given a cover story to explain his death, and when she eventually gave birth to her illegitimate son, she further claimed to the people that he was an immaculately conceived reincarnation of Nimrod. She called him Tammuz, and presented him as the seed of the woman mentioned back in Genesis 3, the Messiah. We know that this verse really refers to Jesus Christ, and so Tammuz was the first Christ imposture, the first Antichrist. Semiramis's rule in the aftermath of this event appeared to be rather shaky, and because of the increased threat to her safety, she took to building walls, towers, and gates around the city of Babylon to defend herself. She was actually the first to build fortifications of this type, and therefore became so associated with this concept that in later times she was often depicted with a crown of turrets. To secure her position, she increasingly emphasized her position as the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven. In other words, she continued to use religious motivation to keep power. As Tammuz grew up and reached maturity, he began demanding to be installed as the new king. Not only did Semiramis refuse this, but seeing that he was becoming a threat to her rule, concocted a plan to have him disposed of in the same manner she disposed of Nimrod. Tammuz, however, caught wind of her scheme and ran her through with a sword before she had the chance to implement it. He then purged the priesthood of all who wouldn't swear allegiance to him to consolidate his position within the religion. This ended Semiramis's 102-year rule. It did not, however, end her relevance. After death, Nimrod continued to be worshipped as the sun god. After Semiramis's death, she continued to be worshipped as the moon goddess, and they continued to be represented by the leading lights of the sky. Semiramis, also known as the Great Mother, Divine Mother, Virgin Mother, etc., would often be depicted standing on a crescent moon with stars encircling her head. Both Nimrod and Semiramis were also given new names in their post-life godly form. Nimrod was confirmed by the priests of the religion as a god called Marduk, and Semiramis was confirmed as a goddess called Astarte. These names, however, were never revealed to the masses, but instead their attributes were set forth under pseudonyms of various gods constructed for the public interest. For example, in Christian terms, we can call God Jehovah Jireh, meaning the Lord who provides, or Jehovah Nissi, which means the Lord is my banner, but we know these different names refer to the same God. In Babylon, however, these different names, which represented different parts of Nimrod's and Semiramis's character, morphed into separate entities altogether, and polytheism, multiple god worship, was truly born. Some of Marduk's alter egos, for example, included Enki, or Apsu, who was the god of wisdom, incantations, and deep water oceans. Another was Astaluhi, the god of healing and exorcism. Another was Nebo, or Nebul, who was believed to have come out of a cave or hole in the ground, and so worship ceremonies were held for Nebo underground. This cave theme became significant in Babylonian beliefs and is a recurring theme. It also curiously echoes Revelation 13, which talks of a beast coming out of the ground. The names Nebul and Bel became the official names of Marduk in later periods, and were popular in these same periods among the ruling classes of Babylon as name elements. In the same way that Muslims are often named Muhammad after their prophet, Babylonians often had names like Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, Marduk was known as Baal. This was the primary name by which the other nations, including Israel, were introduced to the worship of Marduk. Baal means Lord or Master, and was from very early times known as the Sun God. Under this name, with many prefixes and suffixes, he was worshipped by the Canaanites, Phoenicians, Syrians, and to some extent by the Egyptians. The name Baal sometimes occurs in connection with the locality. For example, in Peor, he was known as Baal Peor, or in Hermon, Baal Hermon. More frequently, it occurs with compound attributes such as Baal Zebub, which means Lord of the Flies, still today one of the epithets of Satan. Zebub, meaning fly, comes from the root word that signifies restless motion, and so Beelzebub has a double meaning as Lord of restless and unsettled motion. This agrees precisely with the characteristics of Satan as described in Job 1:7. Baal-Zephon, another famous version, means Lord of the Black North or the Northern Void, and Meribaal translates as Lord of the Rebellion. All these different names are just different sides of the same dice. They all originate with Marduk, who is Nimrod. Finally, because all pagan gods and goddesses originated with the dysfunctional human family of Nimrod, Semiramis, and Tammuz, and the Babylonian system, this clearly affected the views of what the gods and goddesses were like in ancient times. The gods were given family-type structures. The gods had affairs, they argued, they competed for position. They were as prone to family and relational problems as any human. Like Babylon's first family, they even killed each other. Put simply, they were humanized. The Babylonian religion developed in such a way that men began to envision their gods in conformity with the image of man. The gods of the Babylonians were not only understood to interact with each other and operate their affairs as humans do, but they also behaved like humans or worse. As one modern poet wrote, "The more the gods become like men, the easier it is for men to believe the gods. When both have only human appetites, then rogues may worship rogues."
We could go on and on and on for days and months pointing out pagan association after pagan association after pagan association. There's tomes of material. But there's a problem. That argument no longer satisfies. It no longer satisfies. It was effective in the early days of the church when many people were unaware of the pagan associations. But you can now virtually go to anyone and they will tell you, "I'm aware of the pagan associations. That doesn't mean anything to me. I put Christ in Christmas. I put Christ at the center of the holy day. It's about Him. He's the reason for the season. I divest my family of the materialism associated with this day. We have a wonderful, wonderful day. We have a dinner. Family comes over. We spend family time with each other." And you wouldn't believe how my little kids' eyes light up when they open those gifts on Christmas morning. It's a beautiful thing. And so the pagan associations aren't very effective anymore, because they say the intent of the day supersedes the origin. And if I make Christ the center of the celebration, then I'm honoring God, not some pagan deity. And again, beyond Christ being placed at the heart of Christmas, the wonderful benefits of carols, of helping the food bank, of decorating the tree. See, we help other people. We help other people. Wrapping gifts, our kids opening presents, the smells and sounds, and the bonding that occurs in our family has no equal throughout the year. Once a year, we have hope. Now that's a typical response. And therefore they say, "This is a feast to the Lord." This is a feast to the Lord. Now for others, Christmas is so secular that it's just one big party. They don't care much about anything else. They just want to drink and party and have a good time. So how do you respond to that? How do you respond to, I put Christ in the center? It's not about paganism. It's about Christ. What do you say? What do you say? Well, I think a stronger argument would be the concept of syncretism. Syncretism. If it's a new word for you, I'll define it here. This is from the online Encyclopedia Britannica. It is the fusion of diverse religious beliefs and practices. Instances of religious syncretism, as for example, Gnosticism, a religious dualistic system that incorporated elements from the Oriental mystery religions, Judaism, Christianity, Greek, these philosophical concepts, were particularly prevalent during the Hellenistic period. In fact, we have a book, the Book of Colossians, which Paul writes, dealing with the Colossian heresy, which had to do with Gnosticism and this syncretism, this blending of various belief systems. And Paul addresses that in that particular book. I want to give you maybe a visual of what this syncretism looks like. I was going to bring the power behind this, but I chose not to. But let's say I'm making a nice drink for me, a shake. And I take my shake and I want a banana in there. These are fake, these fruit. But I want a banana and I'll put an apple in there. Of course, I'm going to peel them. And then I want it a little sweetener, so I'll put some grapes in there with that as well. And we blend that up. Vroom! That's pretty good, isn't it? That's pretty good. I like that. But now, what happens when I say, all right, I'm going to take some wild Pacific sardines and add in there. That's got to be tasty. Wouldn't you think? What about some two-cycle engine oil? That's got to be helpful. Got to add that to it. Give it a little body. I'm sure it's tasty. And, salt. Put a little salt in there because that's going to bring out the flavors. And then I want some blackened seasoning. Just to put all that in there. And then I say to myself, as my final creative act, that's going to be good. It's going to be good. That is what we might call that culinary syncretism. It's blending, it's putting things together that don't belong together. It's a reconciling of things, trying to make them one. We blend them together as one in order for them to operate and make sense of them. That's what syncretism is. It fuses. It blends together. And religious syncretism is exactly that. It takes a belief system here, puts it in the blender. Takes a belief system here, puts it in the blender. Takes Buddha, puts it in the blender. Takes Taoism, puts it in. Takes Christianity. Yes, Christianity, in a big way. Puts it in the blender and blends it all together and says, it's yours. It's good. It's good. It's good for you. This is your feast. Have at it. Have at it. That's religious syncretism. Now, I want to show you syncretism in all its glory. in all its glory. And how easy it is to become involved in it. So let's look at Exodus 32. Exodus 32, and we'll start in 1 through 9. Exodus 32, verses 1 through 9. You'll remember this account. This is when Moses has been on the mount for some 40 days, and the people are wondering, where is this guy? He brought us out of Egypt. He was our leader, and now he's gone. He's probably dead. And so they come to Aaron, and they make a request. It says, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him.'" Again, likely he's either skipped town or he's dead. Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me." We don't know what's happened to him. We need something to unify us. We need a God. Okay. Give me your gold. So all the people broke off their golden earrings which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a golden calf. Now the word calf there is deceptive. It probably is a young bull of 3 years or less. Very similar to the Egyptian god Apis, the young bull. And so he takes this, probably wasn't all gold. He probably took wood and fashioned it and overlaid it with gold. That was probably the way he built it. And it says, he made a molded calf, and they said, "This is your God, O Israel." And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Interesting that this phrase, "This is the God of Israel, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." It's that same phrase that's used by Jeroboam in 1 Kings. You remember what Jeroboam did? When the kingdom split, he created two calves, two young bulls, and he set them up. The very same phrase. So Aaron in one sense becomes linked to the sin of Jeroboam. That's in 1 Kings 12:28. He says, "Is it too much for you to go up to Jerusalem? Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." Same wording. So then when Aaron saw it, verse 5, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." You should be stunned by that. You should be shocked. Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Lord is YVEH or YWY, Yahweh, Jehovah. It's the real God. Tomorrow is a feast to God. That should shock you. What is going on? What is going on? So this feast is not in honor of the idol, but to the true God, Jehovah. Yahweh. Here's what some of the commentaries say. Get a little background on this. Here's Kaufman's. It is supposed that Aaron thought by such maneuvers to combine the worship of the true God, Jehovah, with the worship of the golden idol, no doubt adopting the fallacious reasoning by which all adultery has been justified in all ages. If so, the device was futile. No matter how they might have looked at it, their actions constituted the most sinful disobedience and idolatry. Now, Benson's commentary is more to the point. Benson is an old conservative Methodist, somewhere around the late 1700s, 1748 to 1821. That's when he lived. Now, you know that shortly after the Protestant Reformation. So, what he says, understand it. Here's what he says about this verse. They proclaimed a feast, namely of dedication, yet he calls it a feast to Jehovah, by which it's still more evident that the people did not intend to terminate their adoration in the image. That's so interesting, isn't it? The people did not intend to terminate, fix their adoration, their worship on the image, but designed to worship the true God in and by this calf, which they meant to consider as only a visible token of God's presence with them and a medium by which to convey their worship to Him. And yet this does not excuse them from the sin of gross idolatry any more than it will excuse the papist, whose plea it is that they do not worship the images which they use, but God or Christ, by the images, so making themselves just such idolaters as the worshipers of the golden calf, whose feast was a feast to Jehovah. It was a feast to Jehovah. And proclaimed to be so, that the most ignorant and unthinking might not mistake it. Now, it's interesting, I find that Psalms 106 recounts this. Psalms 106, verse 19 through 21 says, the people made a calf at Mount Sinai. They bowed before an image made of gold. They traded their glory, their glorious God. They traded their glorious God for a statue of a grass-eating bull. Now get this in verse 21. They forgot God, their Savior. But wait a minute. They didn't forget God. It was just a symbol. It was just a representation. The adoration was not terminating on the symbol. So they didn't forget God. Or did they? The psalmist says, they did. They did. They forgot God. This was based, their rejection was based upon the revelation of man. And we can adopt other forms as long as we can keep the true God central to the feast. We can take this apis. As long as we have the true God central to the feast, we can bring something else in. Perhaps Aaron thought he could control the movement. Various commentators try to reason as to what Aaron was doing. Perhaps he was, again, trying to control the movement, waiting on Moses to come back, and perhaps I'll do this, and I'll combine it with a feast to the Lord, and then I'll eventually get them back to the feast of the Lord. The real feast. It was a horrible, horrible judgment decision that he made. Ellicott's commentary says, in his view, that's Aaron's, no doubt the calf was an emblem of Jehovah, and the worship paid it was the worship of Jehovah. Do you see that? We are really worshiping God, the true God. We're not worshiping this young bull.
It's just a symbol.
Hence, the festival which he proclaimed was to be a feast to Jehovah. Pulpit's commentary. Still, he did not intend that the people should drift away from the worship of Jehovah. No, Aaron didn't want that. He didn't want them to drift away from God. But you know the story. And they rose up to play. They drifted in a major way. And of course, when Moses came back, God said, "You go down. These people, your people, have corrupted themselves. I'm going to tear them up. I'm going to take away their lives from this. I'm going to remove them out of my sight." And Moses pleads for them. Moses pleads for them. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown on this verse. "This is a remarkable circumstance, strongly confirmatory of the view that they had not renounced the worship of Jehovah." They did not renounce the worship of Jehovah. They simply brought in an emblem, a representation, something foreign to the commands of God, in order to worship the true God. So in Aaron's mind, there was a formula. He had a formula in his mind. It goes something like this. Emblem plus Yahweh equals a feast of the brown space. Put it down here. The emblem plus the true God, that is a feast of the Lord. That's God's feast. Don't you see how we put Christ back into Christmas? Don't you see this is God's holy day? Don't you understand that? This was a huge mistake by Aaron and the children of Israel. Huge. In God's mind, the emblem plus Yahweh can never equal a feast of the Lord. This is the God who says, "I am holy. I am holy. I'm totally unique. Now, you be holy because I am holy." I will not accept holiness and unholiness combined. I will not accept light and darkness combined. I am holy. I am holy. Let's review a few scriptures. This is in Exodus 12, Leviticus 23. "Speak to the children of Israel concerning the feast of the Lord." There's your phrase. This is a feast of the Lord. These are the feast of the Lord. And he responds with the first feast being the Sabbath. The Sabbath, which is intricately connected to every one of the feasts of God. You do away with the Sabbath. I think it was Samuel Bakioki who concluded, if you do away with the the holy days, because the link between the Sabbath and the holy days is so strong in these texts. They are the feast of the Lord. If you do away with the holy days, you do away with the Sabbath. They're connected. And so the first feast is the Sabbath, and then he enumerates all the holy days. All the holy days. There can be no substitutes, even if Aaron proclaims it a feast to the Lord. So, in essence, you have Yahweh equals feast of Lord. Now, I'm not saying when I say that, that God is the feast. I'm just saying you can't extract the two, and you can't combine anything else with it. Otherwise, you don't have a feast of the Lord. You have some other being's feast. But you do not have the true God, His feast. All this is religious syncretism. All of it. And whatever the claim, whatever the reason, whatever the evidence presented, none of it persuades God. And it shouldn't persuade you. It should not persuade you. Again, God is holy, His people are to be holy, and He cannot have mixtures. You know, one text here, it's interesting, in Exodus 23:13, God says, "Be careful to do all that I have instructed you." Because God is concerned about how He's worshipped. We don't create within our own minds, this is the way I'm going to worship God. This is the way I'm going to do it. I'm going to add this to it. I'm going to add a little bit of my sardines. I'm going to add a little bit of Babylon. I'm going to add a little bit of Persia or the Greeks. God says, this is the way you will worship me. You remember the details in how God designed and gave all the information, how they were to build the tabernacle in the wilderness. Remember those details? God is very specific. He's very specific about how He will be worshipped and what He requires. He says, "Do not even acknowledge the names of other gods, or let their names spill from your lips." Meaning? Does it mean I can't say Baal or Baal? I don't think that's what it means. You can look at various words within this text. But it means don't even remember or recall them to say there's goodness derived from them. There's no good in them. So don't remember them. Don't let them come off of your lips as if they're good. Another example. This is in, you know, Jesus' response to the Samaritan woman. He says, "You worship you know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." Now she was debating on place. Where do we worship? We worship here, and you Jews, you worship in Jerusalem. And Jesus changes the entire conversation. He changes it to how one worships. How one worships. You don't know what you're worshiping. And he goes on to say, the time is coming when they will not worship in this mountain or that mountain, But all his people shall worship how? What is it? In what? In truth and in spirit. In truth and in spirit. That's how you worship. In truth. Does this day truthfully picture a feast of the Lord? In truth and in spirit. The book of Ezekiel, I won't go there. I'll just note that for you. Ezekiel 8, verse 14 through 16. They're weeping for Tammuz. They're weeping for Tammuz, the women. And there's things here, the men as well. They've taken their backs and they've faced them towards the east, which means the temple is on this side, which indicates they turned their back on God. And they were worshiping the sun. We could talk about Paul rebuking the Galatians for turning to the weak and beggarly elements, which put them in the bondage of their previous Gentile observances. We've already mentioned Jeroboam. So what do we conclude? What we see today is baptized paganism. It's baptized paganism. The golden calf was not a substitute for God or replacement in Aaron's eyes. It was not a substitute or replacement, but intended to be a visual symbol of God. Aaron did not think of his actions as the abandonment of Yahweh. Rather, he was just supplementing worship with customs borrowed from Egypt. Here's what historian Will Durant says. Christianity did not destroy paganism. It adopted it. That's syncretism. It adopted it. It embraced it. It embraced it. And it changed. It changed Christianity significantly. Maybe we'll talk about that in the discussion. The title was a Christmas, a Feast of the Lord. Ellen Reyes asked me, because I sent this to her, she said, should there be a question mark? Essentially, you don't want to state this as a feast to the Lord. I said, well, it's a quote. It's a quote from Exodus. So I said, I'd leave it as is because it creates a striking parallel to creating our own holy days and calling it God's feast like Aaron did. I wrote to her, I said, so in essence, the title of the message captures the same note, a statement that is not capable of being acceptable to God, even when attached to His name. And therein lies the rub. Just because one removes all the materialism and pagan associations of Christmas, no matter how loudly, proudly, or even with good intentions of heart, their claim of the focus being on Christ and it being a feast to the Lord can never make it a feast to the Lord. Is it any wonder then, when we come to the close of the book of Revelation, we read these words. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people. This great Babylon, this great syncretic mixture of religions and beliefs added, supplemented to Christianity. Unless you share in her sins, unless you receive her plagues. That's where we'll end today.